broadcast out of New York City. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. On Monday, October 15, 2012, I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live at our new times from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24-7 on drsaputo.com and prn.fm.
Today you're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 20 to the hour. And we've got a great show for you today that's going to include, is ductal carcinoma in situ a cancer or a benign lesion?
And why are strokes now affecting younger people?
And are healthcare providers trained to deal with the sexual needs of their patients? That's a good one.
And new information on how superbugs spread.
And lastly, what mineral is deficient in vegetarians and in the elderly?
And if you'd like to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics or your health, give us a call on Mondays from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time or 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. With October being Breast Cancer Awareness Month, is DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ, really cancer? Or is it a benign breast lesion? Well, why did the doctor who named it now wish that he didn't use the name carcinoma? And also the word in situ, which means in place, localized. So what is DCIS and why is this a controversy?
Well, this, you're really right. This thing has gotten out of hand. When you get DCIS as a diagnosis, the problem is that only about 2 or 3% are really a cancer, and the other 97 or 98% are not. It's a benign lesion.
And yet they treat them all the same.
Well, it's true, because it's frightening. It's the same thing as when you have an early prostate cancer. It's basically called PINS, which is prostate in situ cancer of the prostate. And even though the number there is 2 or 3% that are malignant, it's the same thing with ductal carcinoma in situ. We wind up treating it with surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. And that means that 97 or 98% of people are being overtreated. They don't need it. And what it really does is it sets the stage for Big Pharma to make a ton of money on the treatment, the doctors to make a lot of money, the surgeons to make a lot of money, the radiologists to make a lot of money, and the patients to get needless treatment.
And do women even know what it is most of the time?
Well, they just got the word cancer in there. As soon as you put the word cancer in there, everybody freaks out. And then the next step is, well, I'm not taking a risk even if it's 1%. I want it out of me.
Well, because is it better, you know, to treat it than to be anxious with a watch and wait kind of diagnosis, you know?
Well, it depends on the person. You know, some people, they've realized that you can watch and wait, and it works just fine. All you got to do is follow this thing, you know, over a period of, I say, 6 to 12-month intervals at the most, and there are lots of ways to follow it.
But you see, if they didn't use that word carcinoma, which is the other definition of cancer,
exactly,
people wouldn't be so scared about watching and waiting. It's like, get this out of me.
Right.
And the other thing about it, Is it palpable? You know, I think it's good to talk about these things because with this being Breast Cancer Awareness Month, people need to learn about this so that they can take responsibilities for themselves and be educated and prepared in case something like this happens to them or to their loved ones. So one of the things that's always pushed for detecting cancer is for a woman to learn how to check her breasts. So is DCIS palpable?
Not usually, but sometimes it can be. And it's when you do these tests, these mammograms, on a regular basis that you start to find them. And that's the problem. I think in women under the age of 50, as a general rule, in my opinion, it's malpractice to do a mammogram. I think we should be doing a test that's not giving radiation out, that doesn't overdiagnose it massively, and doesn't miss a lot of the cancers massively.
But nobody seems to know much about breast thermography or mammotherms.
Well, you're right, and that's, of course, a good way to do it. And in my opinion, what happens when you have DCIS If it's a DCIS, it's going to be a serious one. It's going to light up on a mammogram. And the reason
not a mammogram, a mammotherm.
You're right. I'm thank you very much for that. That would have been a grave error. For a mammotherm to be positive, it has to have angiogenesis, which means a lot of new blood vessel growth. And when you have a lot of new blood vessel growth, you have a lot of heat that shows up on the mammogram on the surface of the skin. When you have that situation, you know you probably have a problem. And in that case, what I would do is either follow the breast thermography or I would consider doing another test. And a lot of the time what I recommend doing, just to see what the extent of things are, is to go ahead and do an MRI. And I do that with contrast, even though the contrast has side effects that can be worrisome in a small percentage of people.
And a mammogram has a radiation side effect, which is worryable.
Well, it takes about 1,800 mammograms to extend the life of one person. And in that process, you will cause one or two cancers. So what are you saving there? You know, you have to really think about this.
And what has this done to this epidemic of breast cancer as far as statistics go?
Well, the problem is that because 98 or 97% of people are going to survive this so-called cancer, what happens is that they get thrown into to all of the breast cancers that exist. And of course, this isn't a breast cancer. So what you're doing is you're stacking the deck with people who never had cancer at all and saying, look at the wonderful result we have. We're doing better with our chemotherapy and with our surgery. But yeah, we're treating people who didn't need it.
So it's increasing it by 30 to 50%, the diagnosis of breast cancer, when 30 to 50% of these are not really a cancer. They're like a precancerous lesion.
That's really the best way to say that. And it's the same thing for prostate cancer. A lot of my patients who wind up with that early prostate cancer, what we do is we just follow them. You can follow the PSA. You can follow them on ultrasound. You can do MRIs and even MRIs with spectroscopy now. They can outline what that looks like. What we need in the screening for breast cancer is a new test. And one giant step forward would be breast thermography. And I'm sure there are other tests that are going to come into clinical practice that will supersede that as well.
It's very difficult to get the Western medical profession to change their ideas about things. You know, sometimes they get an idea stuck in their head. The other thing that happens to them is that they've already put all the money into this technology of doing mammograms and succeeded in brainwashing most of the population.
They brainwash themselves too, Vicki. I've talked with numerous radiologists who I know reasonably well, and they will look at me with respect because they know who I am and what I think. And they tell me on the side, you know, you're right. This is way overdone. We shouldn't be doing this test.
The mammograms.
The mammograms, they say. And people under the age of 50, it should not be done. It does not save lives, and it may actually increase mortality. And it certainly increases morbidity because we're going to be treating people that don't need it. And they tell me they shouldn't be doing the test, but they don't know what to do because it's malpractice. Because that's the standard of practice in the community. When you don't do the standard of practice in the community and something goes wrong, you will get sued. Your medical board will get after you. You may lose your license. It's a terrible thing.
Well, the other thing is, too, is that one of the reasons I think that they're not supporting breast thermography, also referred to as
the mammotherms,
is that they don't know how to read them themselves. So they're doing something that they're comfortable with because they're more comfortable with doing the mammograms. However, the mammograms are not as accurate, and they're giving women a lot of false negatives and a lot of false positives, lot of extra anxiety and concern that they have breast cancer, and many times they don't. And here's another example with the DCIS diagnosis.
Well, breast cancer diagnosis, or I should say diagnosis, breast cancer awareness, doing screening tests is far better with the breast thermography. You're looking there at about 95% of the cancers are picked up. And when it says there's a cancer there, it's right about 90% of the time. When you look at a mammogram, your numbers are at least 10% worse, maybe 15 or 20% worse on both sides of that.
You know, we have so much more about this topic on our website, drsaputo.com, if a person's interested in it, to look that up. Because it's very difficult to stand up to your doctor and say, I don't want to get a breast mammogram,
right,
and that I'd like to get a breast thermography, because most Western doctors don't know much about breast thermography, and they don't recommend it.
Well,
so you have to know how to go about it and who to find,
sure,
that does it and so forth.
Well, it's naive arrogance is what it is on the part of the doctors, particularly the radiologists. I know some radiologists, when they see some of my patients in the past, they take the report that we give them and say, we want you to do an additional test here. Please do an ultrasound or an MRI or whatever it is that we think is the right test to do, and give them the breast thermogram, okay, or the breast thermography report, and they say, this is trash. It doesn't mean anything to us. And my response to that is, well, tell me, doctor, what do you know about breast thermography? And the answer usually is, oh, we know it doesn't work. And I say, have you reviewed the data yourself? And the answer is always no.
And some of what this data does, too, is it increases the survival rate, because they're over-diagnosing the cancer, and the people aren't going to be dying from the DCIS anyway unless they're part of the unlucky 2%.
That's right.
So it's looking like their treatment is successful. So people are thinking, oh, we're, you know, making huge strides in breast cancer treatment and everything, and it's really on something that's not breast cancer.
Well, that's why they're doing this.
So it's like a pseudo disease.
Well, that's exactly right. And then when the radiologists are not trained properly, it becomes a disaster. And I have to agree, there are definitely problems in a lot of people who are doing breast thermography because they don't have enough experience. They're certainly not radiologists most of the time. Hardly ever are they radiologists. And you wind up with some silly comments that are being made. I see on the websites of some people that do breast thermography saying, well, we can diagnose breast cancer 5 or 10 years earlier. That's just bunk. You may be able to diagnose it 6 months or a year or 18 months sooner, but you're not talking about numbers like that. Then the people who read them don't have enough experience. There's something really that's an advantage about having a radiologist participate in that, because they are so well trained. They are superior in interpreting a lot of tests, and this would be one easy test for them to add to their armamentarium so that we could get accurate reports and ones that we could trust. There's nothing like being led astray by somebody who says, oh, you got to do this test now 3 months from now, and or 6 months from now, or a year from now, and you're getting the same score every time. Not necessary to do with the breast thermography. You could do that test, and if you get the same answer, even if it's an abnormal answer, what you're doing is exposing what the baseline finding is for your breast. And if they're staying stable, you don't need to worry about doing tests every 3 to 6 or 9 months or even a year in a lot of cases. So I'm just begging the radiologists, take an objective look at this. Be smart about reviewing the literature. After you have done that, then talk to me about, is this the right test to do? There's a fella up in Canada named Kaiserlink, who has pioneered this feeling, and lots of good research published in the mainstream of medical literature that I think is just a crime for radiologists to ignore. I mean, if it's in their literature, for God's sakes, take a look at it. Give it a chance. See if it's the right thing to do, and then compare it to the other tests you do, and be fair about the assessment that you're making about mammograms. When you're basically addicted to a certain kind of thinking, which they are, no question they are, and they're arrogant about just doing what they usually do, and the data is definitely equivocal, you've got a major problem on your hand, and you have to stretch yourself a little bit further to be able to get the right answer. And if you don't do that, you're committing not just malpractice, you're committing a crime against humanity. Because you're doing tests you shouldn't be doing that are causing problems. That's not right.
Yes, and then treating a precancerous lesion like it's
malignant. Well, with chemotherapy, hello, and radiation. These are not benign things to do. They make people sick. Some people die from the treatment. And you have to look at those numbers before you start jumping off the deep end.
And to look at the new evidence that if it's untreated, that it rarely becomes malignant.
Well, actually, Vicki, that's not new that's not new information.
I know, but they put it in the literature like it's new information.
Well, that's because the medical journals very often don't give us the information in a correct sort of way. So we have to think for ourselves, keep an open mind, stretch yourself beyond the boundaries of where your discipline takes you, even if it's opposing to what the mainstream accepted answers are to a certain question. Now you've got a doctor who can think. That's what you want, and make decisions that are intelligent based on your own exploration, not on what the CDC says, not what the FDA says, not what the World Health Organization says, but what you think, because you've done the homework. And I will tell you, medical doctors rarely do that, particularly in this field.
An overdiagnosis changes a healthy person into a diseased person.
Exactly.
It reminds me a bit of what happens with osteopenia.
That's exactly right.
Osteoporosis is a diagnosis.
Yes.
Osteopenia just means that you're still in a normal range of bone loss.
That's right.
But you're on the border. You're almost to osteoporosis.
You're in the lower segment, that's all.
And so many times what happens is people are treated as if they have osteoporosis.
Well, that's right.
And so it sells more drugs and so forth. And, you know, you can't help but wonder if some of this is what's going on with this DCIS.
There's no question that's right, Vicki. There's no question at all.
There's more biopsies, there's more radiation, there's more chemotherapy,
sure, there's
more money
stress.
Being spent.
I mean, look at a poor woman or who has this diagnosis of ductal carcinoma in situ. I mean, they freak out. I've got cancer. I'm going to die. This is going to be a real problem for me. I can't continue with this. I've got to have it out because I have to be around for my kids and my family and my friends. I don't want to die from this if it's not necessary. Well, you won't, but you may do a lot worse if you go through all the emotional depression that comes from this diagnosis. It's basically a fake diagnosis for cancer, and you go through the treatment because you feel intimidated, and you suffer the consequences of all this misinformation.
Well, however you look at all of this, there's a lot of politics that are surrounding it. Some people are talking about not calling this October Breast Cancer Awareness Month, but Breast Cancer Action Month. Not having marches and walks for the cure, but for the cause. We need to get at the cause. And all this pinkwashing, which means about all these runs and walks that are going on. A lot of this is just political to sell products, and a lot of these companies that are putting on these walks are selling products that contain things that cause the breast cancer. Look at some of the toxins that are in some of the cosmetics with some of these big companies like Revlon and Avon and Estee Lauder and all that. Even Susan B. Komen, they had a walk, and they have a lot of walks.
Yeah.
And
they walk to the bank is what they do.
They've been sponsoring a perfume, Promise Me, that it has carcinogens in it. So these companies are making money off of cancer. You need to research and think about when you're, you know, getting involved with a lot of these things. So if you want to learn more about pinkwashing, we have that also on our website, drsaputo.com.
Well, go to Vicki's Corner on that site, and what you'll find is a ton of information about that particular side of what we're talking about. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. We're opening up the lines at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. So give us a call if you have a question about your health or what we're discussing. We'd love to hear from you. And now it's time for Vicki's first 2020 tip on why freeze the whole lemon. Then we'll come back with why are strokes now affecting younger people.
You use a whole lemon without wasting it? Well, you place the washed lemon in the freezer.
In the freezer?
And once the lemon's frozen, you get your grater out and you shred the whole lemon. You don't have to peel it or anything. And then you can just sprinkle it on top of your foods, you know, things like vegetable salad and ice cream and soup and cereals and noodles and spaghetti sauce and rice and sushi and fish dishes and whiskey and wine and whatever. The list goes on.
And it's got a new kind of tangy flavor, doesn't it? Because a peel has a lot of flavor in it and a ton of nutrients, doesn't it?
And they contain 5 to 10 times more vitamins than the lemon juice itself. So the lemon peels are health rejuvenators, and they have help us to eradicate the toxic elements in our bodies.
Uh-huh.
So it makes your food tastier, and you get to live healthier and longer. And, you know, there's some that say that lemon may actually kill cancer cells and prevent cancer. And, you know, it tastes good and it doesn't produce chemotherapy. But anyhow, besides a possible remedy against cancers of all types, it's also an antimicrobial. It works against the bacterial and the fungi. It also is effective against internal parasites and worms. It regulates blood pressure. It's an antidepressant. Gee. It combats stress. It does all these wonderful things. So
Mother Nature is brilliant the way she puts this together. Awesome. Don't we wish we had a pill that would do that?
Yeah.
Talk about a blockbuster pill we'd have.
Well, there are some that even claim that lemon might even work better than chemo, but that's not really supported by facts. But, you know, it's worth listening to, and it's certainly not going to hurt you, and it tastes good, and it's a healthy thing to do anyway. So lemons have a vast reservoir of promising anti-carcinogens, along with, you know, the vitamin C flavonoids, and it may help and other antioxidants, but it also contains B6 and potassium and folic acid and limonene, so it can't hurt anything to include a whole lemon with all these health benefits. And other citrus fruits also actually can contain a lot of these limonoids. So wash your lemons and freeze them and grate them, and your whole body's going to love you for it.
Right. You know, there's some data that looks at modified citrus pectin, which is coming from the white part of the fruit, that does a lot to prevent cancer. That we know about. And there's some good companies that are making that product. And a lot of doctors who have scoured the literature add that to patients who have cancer. Because if it can, you can do something that simple and take it in a pill form, why not? If that can prevent cancer, that's a great deal. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
So why are we seeing strokes more often in the young? I mean, what could be the reason for such an increase in the 20 to 54 age group? Let's talk about this new research and what some of the reasons are.
Well, a lot of things are changing. You know, when we look at people who are under age 55, over the last decade, the number of strokes has risen from 13% to 19%. That's a staggering change of a major illness. When you look at people that are over age 70, now the risk has come down a little bit from age 71 to age 69. So even those people are having strokes at a younger age too. So something has changed. Is it our environment? Is it what we're eating? Is it stress? Is it lack of sleep? Is it lack of our immune system responding to protect us against these kinds of problems?
Well, one of the things we hear about lately, you know, is that there's a rise in diabetes and obesity and
sure.
high cholesterol, so that's probably part of it.
No question that that's adding to it. Our lifestyle is extremely important, and inflammation is what we need to avoid. When we look at people who have hypertension, for example, that there are a lot of people that risk is going up. So when you have a high risk of high blood pressure, it's going to cause two things. One is it's going to make more plaque, okay, at areas where there's more pressure. And in some places, it's going to actually cause a rupture of the blood vessel. And, of course, instead of getting a clot in that setting, you get a bleed, which is even worse. Because if you're bleeding into your brain, the kind of consequence the stroke will be much worse. So hypertension's a big issue and does it both ways.
They're probably being diagnosed more now, too, because there's more tests to diagnose it, like the MRIs.
Well, that's right. We're finding a lot of strokes where people didn't have any symptoms from it, and that's not uncommon at all.
And what about these carotid arteriograms that are being done all the time?
The ultrasounds, yeah.
The ultrasounds, yeah.
Well, they're finding more problems, too. What we're finding is that the cholesterol issues are getting out of hand, because whenever there's inflammation, this innocent bystander called cholesterol is a reflector that we've got a problem that we should be tending to. And what we tend to do is treat that with drugs to lower the cholesterol and to improve the ratio so that we don't have too much LDL, which is the bad stuff, and we have more of the HDL, which is the good stuff, that protects against cholesterol-causing problems. So When that happens, we need to pay more attention to our lifestyle, and that's what we should be treating people with who have a cholesterol issue, because it's saying, look, your body's inflamed. And the answer isn't a statin drug, which is what a lot of doctors do. It's almost like a reflex. As soon as we have problems with cholesterol being high, the next thing we do is we start thinking of statins. And the data does not support, in the mainstream, it doesn't support the use of statins for primary prevention. If you've had a heart attack or a stroke, it can lower the risk for having another heart attack or stroke. But the best medicine is always lifestyle. It's diet, exercise, stress reduction, sleep, weight, exposure to toxic chemicals, and, of course, having a meaningful purpose in your life. Those are the things we need to pay attention to. And then there's a part that has to do with more coagulation in our a tendency for coagulation of our blood.
And that's why so many people are taking aspirin, but there are healthier alternatives than aspirin.
Well, aspirin is not indicated if you haven't had a heart attack or a stroke. And in my opinion, it's almost never indicated because it causes bleeding. And the bleeding may be in your brain, it may be in your eye, it may be in other places. And those results that you get from it happen more often than we save lives or prevent heart attacks and strokes. And there's a wonderful alternative.
Fish oil.
Exactly. Why not do something that works just as well as aspirin, that doesn't cause the side effects, and actually boosts your omega-3 and omega-6 essential fatty acids, which our body can't make and has to have.
There are a lot of other things that can cause strokes, too, like medications and toxins. And I was thinking about this younger age group where the incidence of strokes has increased. What about the incidence of people taking birth control pills and HRT and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs?
Right.
And even now, we've got all these GMOs in food that we're eating. We don't even know what some of the effect that some of that could have on our incidence of having strokes and pesticides.
Right. Well, that's
but
right.
Our environment is just loaded with toxins and chemicals, so we need to pay attention to that.
Well, that's absolutely right. And we need to start being proactive. There is no medicine that does what lifestyle does. It doesn't come close. If there were, it would be the biggest blockbuster drug of all time, because it would mean that you can defy Mother Nature and not do the kinds of things that are going to keep you healthy.
Well, also, I think it's good for doctors to be a little more open-minded about some of these other wonderful screening tests that can be done. Besides, we were talking about the carotid ultrasound, but what about vascular stiffness and live blood cell analysis and heart rate variability tests?
Well, these are all good things to do to make a careful assessment of what's happening.
You can see with a live blood cell analysis, you can just see what happens with your blood.
Absolutely.
You had that done when you were so sick with your metallosis from your hip, and you could see how your blood was thick and there was extra fibrin and all that.
My blood looked like glue. It looked like glue.
But you challenged it with some fish oil, and within an hour, it all cleared up. It was just like a miracle.
Well, it helps to prevent heart attacks and strokes and other vascular problems. I mean, when you have cobalt poisoning from a hip replacement because it's metal on metal and it's not put in as straight as it should be, you have a serious problem with hypercoagulation, hypothyroidism, peripheral neuropathies, and cardiomyopathies. And I had all that when I had my complications from a metal-on-metal hip replacement. So that's gone, the coagulation is gone, and all the other stuff is gone, and thank God I'm back on the tennis court.
Yeah, and another thing that can cause a stroke is atrial fibrillation. So that's why EKGs are good to do, because the blood kind of quivers in the upper chamber of the heart, and it can cause a clot and throw it off.
All right, it's time for a PRN.FM station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The lines are open at 888-874-4888. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be talking about our health care providers trained to deal with the sexual needs of their patients. You listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo with Nurse Vicki. The number, if you have a question about your health or you want to talk about some of the items we've been talking about on the show, is 888-874-4888.
So do healthcare professionals really need training to deal with the sexual needs of their patients?
Well, it's not talked about much, Vicki, in our training, and we sort of just close our eyes to it when it's in the hospital or someplace else like that.
Well, it seems to be kind of like a hush-hush topic up until now, and people with these acquired physical disabilities have intimate questions and concerns many times, and the healthcare professional should be prepared to discuss this with their patients rather than to just ignore it or skip over it, which is so easy to do because it's uncomfortable.
Well, there are some things that we just don't get trained in, and this is one of them. And if you're not trained, you really don't know the professional side of how to deal with that. But sex is a big part of our life. In fact, in our early years, I'd say under the age of about 70, it's a big thing in everybody's life. Our culture is centered around it. And then when we get into the hospital, the convalescent hospital or something like that, all of a sudden it's hush hush. Let's not go there because it's a taboo thing to talk about.
Well, you know, I remember years ago when I was in my nursing training, and I was at rehab, and I was taking care of two of my patients were quadriplegic, so that meant that they were paralyzed from the neck down. And this one man who was just, he was a very talented person before his accident.
Uh-huh.
He'd had a car accident, and he was an artist, and he was building a sailboat so that he could travel the world, and he was on his way to go say goodbye to all of his friends and family for a party, and he was in this accident, and he broke his neck and was paralyzed. So he was trapped in his body, and he was very frustrated and unhappy, and I was giving him a bath, and he got an erection. Well, I didn't say anything. I just ignored it, and he didn't actually say anything about it. But right around that time, this other patient came walking into the room that had had a brain injury, and he was walking kind of weird, and he didn't have all of his mental facilities. And so my patient said, I would much rather be like him than to be like myself, because if I were like him, I wouldn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
And so I was just bringing this up because I didn't know what to say, and I didn't know how to handle it. I also had another patient at that same facility that was a teenage boy that had been in an accident. Of course, I don't think it was my place to explain the sexual part to him, but he was talking like he thought he was going to live this normal life when he got out of there, and he was going to have a family and everything else, and he was totally paralyzed forever.
Oh boy.
So I think that this is a good thing that this is now coming to the front, that healthcare workers need to know how to deal with the patients and how to make it easier for them to discuss it and to talk about it.
Right. It's not just the doctors that should know that. I think that the nurses definitely should know that too, because who takes care of patients? It's not the doctors. The doctors are busy making diagnoses and ordering tests, but who's taking care of the patients? It's the nurses, and you've got to be trained to know what to do there.
Yeah, and so this new research shows that the patients are dissatisfied with the support around this issue during
the lack of it. That's right.
During their rehabilitation. And, you know, there are changes with acquired physical disabilities that can diminish a person's self-esteem, their sense of attractiveness, and their relationships and their sexual functioning.
Well, when we ignore things like that, we just miss out. I mean, look at the movie The Notebook. What a beautiful story, talking about somebody, a woman who has Alzheimer's disease and can't remember a lot, but from time to time has her memory come back, and a husband that's absolutely dedicated to her. And in the last scenes of the movie, they climb in bed together, and the nurse at least has the wisdom to leave them alone and shut the door. And in the morning, they're both gone. But what a beautiful way to make things complete. I mean, sex is a big part of our life, and it doesn't have to mean having intercourse. You can just cuddle or be together. And when you're in the hospital, that's a time when you really need more of it, and we don't get that touch.
And sometimes it not only just helps the patient, but it helps the person that loves them to be able to snuggle with them and hold them and be with them. And I think that we need to be more aware of all this. I think, you know, sometimes people that are in these problems are people like I mentioned earlier with brain injury and strokes, people that are incontinent. This needs to be a topic to be discussed, you know, probably with the doctor.
Well, if you're talking about wearing a catheter, okay, and particularly if you're a woman or a man, and you're in a relationship that's new and it's got and it's physical, I mean, you can't be doing things like that and expect to have a normal sex life. That becomes a big challenge. It changes everything.
And erectile dysfunction, we hear about that all the time. But
sure.
do the doctors really talk about it with their patients? I don't know.
Well, some do. People come to me sometimes talking about that. And then we're looking at the various things you can do that can make a big difference. Anyway, the lines are open here. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on a mature lady driver. And we'll have, following that, some new information on how superbugs spread and what mineral is deficient in vegetarians and the elderly.
Losing a driver's license for the elderly can change their quality of life and dependency on others, you know, like lack of self-sufficiency, and it can lead to being homebound. And also having a sense of humor can save our lives because laughter is the best medicine.
Indeed.
So here's how this mature lady that was over 70 gets pulled over for speeding and how she handles it. Is there a problem, officer? Ma'am, you were speeding. Oh, I see. Well, can I see your license, please? Well, I'd give it to you, but I don't have one. You don't have one? Well, I lost it 4 years ago for drunk driving. Well, I see. Can I see your vehicle registration papers, please? Oh, I can't do that. Why not? Well, I stole this car. Stole it? Yes, and I killed and hacked up the owner. You what? His body parts are in plastic bags in the trunk if you want to see. Well, the officer looks at the woman and slowly backs away to his car and calls for backup.
Yeah.
So within 5 minutes, police cars circle the car and a senior officer slowly approaches the car, clasping his half-drawn gun. Ma'am, could you step out of your vehicle, please? So the woman steps out of her vehicle. Is there a problem, sir? One of my officers told me that you have stolen this car and murdered the owner. Murdered the owner? Yes, could you please open the trunk of your car, please? So she opens her trunk, revealing nothing but an empty trunk. Is this your car, ma'am? Yes, here are the registration papers. Well, one of my officers claims that you do not have a driving license. So she digs into her handbag and she pulls out a clutch purse and hands it to the officer. And the officer examines the license and he looks kind of puzzled. Well, thank you, ma'am. One of my officers told me you didn't have a license, that you stole this car and that you murdered and hacked up the owner. And the woman says, bet the liar told you I was speeding too.
That's great.
Don't mess with mature ladies.
No.
So keep your sense of humor and drive carefully.
Indeed. Don't mess with any women. It just doesn't pay off.
Yep.
Be a good listener and care, and you go a lot further when you're dealing with anybody, but especially women. All right. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
We're always hearing about superbugs, and it's really important to learn about them and know about them, because now we've found out that they're not just on surfaces. They're floating around in the hospital air. Boy, there is another reason not to go to the hospital.
That's so right.
The main superbugs are the MRSA, the methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, and the C. diff, which is Clostridium difficile. So let's define how these bugs become resistant again.
Well, it's over-treatment with antibiotics in the hospital especially, but also outside the hospital. When you start killing all the bugs that are the least aggressive because you're using antibiotics and other things that are not a good idea to use, what happens is those bugs die, and what's left are the ones that are resistant to it. So by using repeated antibiotics, what you're doing is you're selecting out those bugs that are more aggressive, more virulent, and don't respond to the antibiotics. So now we have an epidemic of MRSA inside the hospital, outside the hospital, and the same thing with C. diff. And it's becoming more and more difficult to treat because a lot of the time, no antibiotic works.
I was just reading an article the other day also about areas where cattle are raised with antibiotics, that the people that live around them are getting some of these antibiotic-resistant infections.
Well, that's right. I mean, you'd have to expect that because they're giving antibiotics to all kinds of animals and not just cattle. And what happens is their intestinal tracts then become culture media for resistant bugs that if you catch an infection from them, you're in big pucky because the antibiotics don't work anymore.
So now we know it's not enough to just clean the surfaces, and so they're spreading through the air vents in the hospital when the patients that are infected are coughing or sneezing, or the healthcare workers are shaking their bed linens because it's going through these air vents.
Right.
So the hospital and the people that they're the experts are recommending that they remodel the hospitals, I guess, and position the windows differently and the doors and the air vents. But, you know, we talked, I don't know when it was, about a year ago, we were talking about copper surfaces.
Oh, yes.
And it came out in the news about how copper kills all these germs, and if we could put it on the doors and on the light switches and on the patient's bedside stands and on, that we could just kill these bugs right away anyway.
Well, that's true, and the study that was done in the intensive care unit doing this, and what they found is the rate of infection went way down and the rate of survival went way up as well. So copper is something that should be used. Now, you might say, well, that's awfully expensive. But look at the cost of one person in the hospital who's in the ICU for a month trying to fight one of these things off.
Exactly.
You're looking at $500,000 or sometimes $1 million. Now, it wouldn't cost anywhere near that much money to do one room, which would save that room immense numbers of infections with serious microbes that can kill you or maim you.
So what we're doing now is using all these toxic chemicals to kill all these germs, and the ones that survive it are the ones that are resistant.
Yeah, it makes no sense, does it?
So, you know, years ago they used to use ultraviolet lights in the operating room.
Well, that could be something that's still done and could be applied to the rooms where patients are when they're, you know, when one patient goes home or something else happens, you could do the UV light treatment. It would do a lot to sterilize the air. Another thing you could do is you could use ozone in areas like that when the patient's not in the room, which should sterilize a lot of it and then wash it out because it washes out real easily, and you would have less in the way of infections because it kills all microbes, not just some.
And then what about probiotics in the air? Maybe they could put some of those in the vents. Would that work, do you think?
Well, I think for patients that aren't real sick with infection or have severe immune deficiencies, that's something to think about. I remember talking about this 30 years ago with some of the infectious disease people, and they actually at that time thought it was a good idea, and I do too, because I think that what would happen is you would crowd out those bad bacteria, but if you open up the whole area because there are no bugs there at all because you've killed, or at least bugs that are there are ones that are resistant to the antibiotics or whatever cleaning agents you have, that's going to cause problems. So it's something to think about. It would be something reasonable. The other thing that we could do that we don't take into account is this idea of using photooxidation. And what that is a way of delivering ultraviolet light, which does some very interesting things to people when you put it and shine it over their blood. So what you can do is you can put a needle into a vein. You can run out that blood from that vein through
tubing,
and run that back into the body. And while it's outside of the body, you can shine UV light on it. When you do that, it makes blood carry oxygen better and to release it better in the tissues, which means you deliver more oxygen to the system. But it also gets the blood able to fight bacteria exceptionally well. In the pre-antibiotic era, when we had no antibiotics, that's back in the 40s, some studies were published in the medical journal called Surgery on about 250 consecutive cases of people who had severe abdominal infections called peritonitis. And a lot of these people were in the ICU and literally dying, and maybe days from dying. And when they treated their blood with this photooxidation approach, they didn't die anymore. About half of them survived, which is miraculous. We still don't have that kind of result today when we use antibiotics. And when you take people that were just in the hospital with mild peritonitis, nearly all of them got better after just a few treatments of that, and that was in within just a few days.
But then antibiotics were discovered.
Right, and you can say bye-bye to photooxidation, but there are still a few doctors around who know this, who are trying to use it, but try to use it in the ICU or in the hospital, and people won't let you do it because it's not the standard of practice. We need to stop being arrogant about the way we do things and start being open-minded to anything that could work.
And overdoing the antibiotics when we don't need them, with 100,000 deaths every year from these superbugs.
Well, it's a big deal, and we should be paying attention to every opportunity we have to make things work better. The other thing we could do is we could start, you know, filtering our air ducts better. Maybe we should run UV light in our air duct system so it's sterilized and we're not going to have the problem of spreading it from one room to another. And you could use UV light in those ducts because it wouldn't affect patients because it would never get to them, but it would kill the microbes.
So it would kill the superbugs.
Kill everything. Mm-hmm. And that's what you want in an air duct system, which needs to be cleaned periodically also, because the amount of contamination that builds up in those ducts is absolutely stunning.
I think we're going to have to get rid of wards in the hospital and just have all private rooms.
Well, it would be a better thing to do from that point of view, for sure. Plus, it's a lot more restful. What you don't want to have is a hospital room with another patient in there who's demented or is confused or is delirious, and it's making it hard for you to rest, because the idea of being in the hospital is to provide an environment that's better for you.
Or coughing or sneezing.
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, when they did this study at the University of Leeds in England, they found that in a special chamber that's called a biological aerosol chamber, and they put in there a mannequin that was infected with MRSA and kept it at body temperature, that those bugs would travel as much as 10 feet. So you're talking about spread through the air with air currents, a lot of microbes that can contaminate a room and, of course, spread to other rooms as well. So we've got an issue here that needs to be respected and worked on in a way that we don't have so much of a problem with contamination in the hospital. When you're looking at 3 to 5% of people who come into the hospital without an infection, particularly surgical patients, coming out with an infection that's a superbug, MRSA in particular, that's a stunning number. That means 1 in 20 or 1 in 30 people are going to be coming out of the hospital, or maybe not coming out of the hospital, because of the high number of deaths that are associated with this. And you're looking at 100,000 people a year. That's a huge number that is probably largely preventable with some of the things we're talking about. All right, the lines are open. The number is 888-874-4888.
What mineral is often deficient in those over 65 and also in vegetarians? You know, plus 70% of Americans don't consume the recommended dietary allowance of zinc. You know, sometimes it's important to supplement our diets, especially if we are vegetarians or we're older. For one thing, as we age, we lose our ability to absorb zinc by 10 times. So why do vegetarians need to supplement with zinc?
Well, it's the same thing. Most of what we eat that has zinc in it is seafood and meat. So we need to get it from there. And it's difficult to get it from grains and vegetables because of the phytate level that's high in people, in those vegetables and in those grains, that binds the zinc so that you can't absorb it. And when you have that in combination with people who are not who are older, that their dietary intake for zinc is 10 times higher, I mean, you're looking at a problem that's not going to be resolved very easily.
So how much zinc do we need?
Well, normally men need about 11 milligrams a day, and women need about 8 milligrams a day. But if you're older, you may need as much as 100 milligrams a day, but that would be a toxic dose to give most people, because you don't want to be taking too much zinc. So you need to know a person's metabolism. You need to know how old they are. You also need to know how much they're consuming, because if they're not taking it in, I mean, it's not going to, you're not going to have enough.
What does zinc do for us, and why is it a problem if we're deficient in it? What happens?
Well, we're looking at immune dysfunction, impairments in growth, cognitive function, abnormal hormonal function, or insulin doesn't, I mean, you can't make insulin without zinc. All these things are important things. About 70% of Americans don't even consume the recommended daily allowance for zinc, and about 10% of people, they don't even consume half the RDAs for zinc. And when you're in a hospital or in a stressful situation, you need to have a lot more than just the RDAs, because your body's requirements for a lot of nutritional substances goes way up.
This is probably why it's recommended for colds.
Well, yeah.
The immune system's down.
And if you give enough zinc when you have a cold, it works just fine. If you don't take enough zinc, it doesn't do anything. So you have to make sure you get about 70 milligrams a day in the lozenges that we use to be able to get a cold to be shortened and be less severe by a couple of days. And that's the best way to treat it.
Well, this is a biggie when it comes to inflammation, because inflammation is, as we all know, is the biggest cause of disease. And so it can lead to things like cancer and heart disease and autoimmune diseases and diabetes. And you can even die from inflammation. So this is a good thing to make sure we have enough in our diet. And if a person is a vegetarian, or if they're aging, they definitely need to supplement with some zinc.
Right. The other thing that happens is, if you don't have enough zinc, you're going to extract copper and absorb more of that, because the way the body absorbs copper and zinc is the same transport mechanism in the gut. So if you don't have enough of one, you'll absorb more of the other. And if you absorb too much copper, it causes all kinds of problems in the body.
Well, there's some other causes for low levels of zinc besides being a vegetarian or being elderly. It's malabsorption, diarrhea, liver, kidney disease, diabetes, cancer, intestinal bypass surgery is another one.
Right. Well, there are lots of ways to go wrong. So we need to pay a lot more attention to our nutrition. You know, it's one thing that we don't get much training in as doctors, because we're so preoccupied with trying to find drugs or technologies or surgeries to solve our healthcare issues. And of course, that means we're ignoring lifestyle. And all these things are different in different people. So we need to know when to do what. So you need a good doctor who will look at things from a more holistic perspective and give you what you need depending on what your situation is.
Well, some little things a person could notice themselves would be, if they have white spots on their nails, it might mean that they have a deficiency of zinc.
That's right. It could
be. I remember when I was little, I used to have all those little white things on my fingernails.
Well, you may not have had enough in the way of zinc consumption.
Yeah,
that's right.
What I'm thinking now. Well, anyway, acne, skin lesions, and like you said, high levels of copper. But with this RDA, I thought it was interesting also that it's the same for young adults as it is for the elderly. So I think it's time to reassess this.
Well,
hopefully the government will pay attention to this, or whoever makes the RDAs.
Well, the RDAs in general are way too low for everybody, because what we're looking at is the minimum amount. I mean, you talk about the RDAs for vitamin C. You're trying to prevent scurvy with that. You're not talking about boosting immunity or having a normal tissue healing or any of the other things vitamin C does if you don't have enough. And if you're sick, I mean, then the RDAs are even higher, and there's an awful lot of information that's out about vitamin C that can be used, that Linus Pauling introduced about 40 or 50 years ago, that we've just basically ignored. You give IV vitamin C to people who have certain kinds of health problems, and it does magical things. And we don't even look at it, because it's not regarded as a drug, and of course it doesn't cost very much to use it. So it can't be patented, and so basically doctors close their eyes to it because they're brainwashed.
Well, what about zinc and epigenetics and our DNA? Because I don't think we can repair DNA damage without zinc.
No, it's one of the important things that zinc does, is it boosts immune function, but it also works in DNA replication and transcription and repair. It's also found in about 300 enzymes, including a lot of the ones that are used to protect against oxidation, which of course causes damage to DNA, and lots of mutations. So the epigenetics of this is huge. You know, we don't think so much about epigenetics, we think about genetics, meaning that we're looking at mainly those kinds of things that happen because we have genes that are deficient to start with that are inherited. But the epigenetic effects from the environment changes what these things, what our genes do immensely. And a lot of the time you can overcome some of those problems that occur just by living a healthy lifestyle. So,
you know, too, with the big high incidence of prostate cancer in men, you know, increasing so rapidly after 50, zinc is a good thing. Things to take for that, too.
Absolutely. Well, we're at the close of the show again. I'd like to remind you that we'll be back to talk live about what's new in the news and health, to take your health questions every Monday morning on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 10 to 11 Eastern Time and 7 to 8 Pacific Time. Prescriptions for health will also be available 24-7 on DrSaputo.com as well as PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on DrSaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. Remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe, so if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a great week, and we'll talk to you next time.